Statistics and measurements can be important in our life. For example, knowing the amount of gas that you have left in your tank can, at times in life, be very important. The percent charge on your phone or on a wireless device can be incredibly important when perhaps the power goes out and you realize you need to maintain contact with the outside world. Depending on your position and where you are and how much you enjoy school, the amount of the school year that has already been completed might mean something to you. Or you might look at it the other way and say, how much more do I have left? Naturally, the amount of time that's left in any church service is an important statistic. When I was growing up in the church, I would sit in the audience and I would calculate in my head what percentage was left if they finished on time. Now back then, you know, when I was a young boy in the church, oftentimes we didn't end on time. We would have someone who would be very passionate and would decide to go on for an extra 30 minutes, and hopefully that won't happen today. But you could figure that out, and you could think, okay, now we're down to 20% left. Can I make it? It was very frowned upon when I was growing up in the church to ever leave to go to the restroom. So as a kid, that was something you were not supposed to do. So you would get, sometimes it was dire that you were calculating and hoping they were finishing, as some of you might very well be doing right now. We deal with numbers across life. Some are significant, some are mundane. But as of this moment, we are approximately 13.9% done, give or take a few shaves of percentage on that, depending on the exact time. Of course, that statistic means nothing to us without its context. I mean, what does somebody mean if you're 13.9% done? Well, we are 13.9% approximately. Again, you could take this percentage a little bit either way. We are 13.9% complete in our count to the next annual holy day, or at least to the beginning of that holy day. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 23. As we've closed out the days of unleavened bread, we often naturally turn to the next great event on God's annual cycle of holy days. And in Leviticus chapter 23, we'll begin in verse 15. Leviticus 23, verse 15. We have this affirmative instruction here. It says, "And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring from your dwellings 2 wave loaves of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be of fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits to the Lord." In verse 21, it says, "And you shall proclaim on the same day that it is a holy convocation to you. You shall do no customary work on it. It shall be a statute forever in all your dwellings throughout your generations." Of course, this is speaking of the Feast of Pentecost. It's often referenced as the Feast of Weeks, as you can understand. Count 7 weeks, and then it's the next day, and we would have the Feast of Pentecost. Don't need to turn there, but in Exodus 23, we're told 3 times, "You shall keep a feast to me in the year." And God talks about Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And then in verse 16, it says, "And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field." That, of course, is the day that we are looking forward to. It's commonly referred to in our day and age as the Feast of Pentecost. Of course, from the Greek for counting 50, or Pentecost, so we count 50 days to arrive at that day. Seems simple. But when do we start this count? We can almost all count to 50, even Lachlan. But when do we start? How do we know where to start? The answer is found in an unusual custom or ceremony that's found here in Leviticus chapter 23. It's a ceremony that doesn't garner much attention. We don't talk about it very often because we can look on our calendar the church sends us and it tells us when Pentecost is. But we find this ceremony in Leviticus 23 and verse 9. We'll just read through this passage, verses 9 through 14. It says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, When you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year without blemish, as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma, and its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. This waving of a sheaf of the first fruits, often simply referred to as the wave sheaf, is a relatively straightforward ceremony. It references a rather quick, at least by modern standards, likely seemingly insignificant ritual. And yet, God devotes quite a bit of real estate on the page that's devoted to this event. So is it important for us as Christians? Does it matter? Do we need to know about it or understand it? And is there more to this wave sheaf than just an annual ceremonial rite of an ancient people? In this split message today, I'd like for us to review the wave sheaf ceremony and examine its relevance, if any, for us as Christians. I know we cover this periodically, but I think it's been almost 10 years or so here in Louisville since we've kind of walked through this. So let's consider that today. I'd like to offer a few key details or points before we dig into what this is for. First of that is that the day of the wave sheaf ceremony, the day that it was conducted, was not and is not an annual holy day. It's rather unfortunate in many modern Bibles if you have these headings that have been inserted by the publisher to add clarity in their view. And many times those headings do add clarity. But if you have a relatively recent print version of the Bible, you likely have a heading above verse 9. It breaks the thought here in Leviticus 23, and you likely have a heading that says the Feast of First Fruits. And so it separates it out from the days of unleavened bread, which can cause some confusion. But you'll notice as you read through Leviticus 23 that all of the annual holy days of God are declared to be holy convocations. And there's the apodictic instruction to do no customary work, or in the case of atonement, to do no manner of work. And neither of those phrases is applied to the day that the wave sheaf ceremony would be conducted. Also, the day of the wave sheaf ceremony is nowhere referenced as a Sabbath in Scripture. There's no reference to this ceremony as being on a Sabbath. And there was, and there still is, no commanded assembly on that day in every year. Now, some would point to the fact that, well, there are offerings that were offered on that day. We just read through that passage, verses 9 through 14, and there were burnt offerings and grain offerings and drink offerings that were offered on that day. But that does not make it a holy day. In fact, the offerings were made to God on every other day of the week as well. So the mere fact that offerings were given anciently does not make it a holy day. And in the New Testament, there is no evidence at all that the early church maintained or practiced this ceremony, which, of course, we'll see there's good reason for. And this, of course, is why the church has not and does not have assemblies on this day every year. But it's still worthy of our exploration and discussion. This is something we do need to have a frame of reference about because it's the day that we start the count on. To understand the significance of this ceremonial rite, we have to have a basic understanding of the harvests in the land of Canaan. In the land of Canaan, they had the early harvest. We often refer to it as the spring harvest, which is kind of a misnomer, because this harvest began with the barley harvest around the days of unleavened bread, and it would go all the way through the wheat harvest that would culminate at Pentecost. So it was really a early spring to early summer harvest. And then in the land of Canaan, they had the late harvest, the fall harvest, as we often call it. And this is where they would harvest the grapes and the remnants of certain grains. the summer fruits that would be so delicacies to them in many ways, and they would celebrate this at the Feast of Ingathering or the Feast of Tabernacles. The wave sheaf that we read about here in Leviticus 23 was used to denote the start of this annual cycle, this cycle of harvest. So when did it occur? When was it to be completed on? And I will grant you, this is a bit technical, so you don't have to take all the notes. You do have to almost write this out, draw a diagram yourself perhaps to make this real clear. But we're told in Leviticus 23 and verse 11, we're told something quite simple. You shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath. And that seems clear enough. It's on the day after the Sabbath. But which Sabbath? And that's really the question. How do we know? It could be any random Sabbath. I mean, one could argue, well, it doesn't specify, so we could pick any random Sabbath. But that couldn't be the case. It's both illogical. It also ignores the context of Leviticus 23, which is a schedule of God's holy days. And also, due to the annual harvest cycle, it couldn't have been delayed too much because they couldn't just ignore the ripening barley in the fields. They had to start the harvest. So a person couldn't have decided, I don't like the spring, I'm going to wait. How about we do the wave sheaf in, oh, I don't know, August, when it's really nice and hot. That wasn't an option for them. So it couldn't be any Sabbath that a person chose. Another option would be, based on the context, maybe it was after the first day of unleavened bread. That would be a high Sabbath. Maybe that's what God intended, that it would be on day two of the days of unleavened bread. This is what most practicing Jews do today. That's why they don't count for Pentecost. For most practicing Jews, Pentecost is always on Sivan the 6th. No matter what day of the week it might be, it's on their calendar because it's always, they start their count on the day after the first day of unleavened bread, which is, of course, always on the 15th of the first month. One could also read this passage and argue, well, maybe it's after the last day of unleavened bread. After all, that would be a high Sabbath. Maybe that's the Sabbath in question. How do we know? Well, contextually, the wave sheaf is certainly linked to Passover and the days of unleavened bread. If you ignore the heading that the publisher likely inserted into your Bible above verse 9, since this is a list of God's holy days, we have the holy days of the first day and the last day of unleavened bread. The next one is Pentecost. So this is wedged there in the middle, and it's connected to the days of unleavened bread. It's also connected to unleavened bread because it's related to this first sheaf of their harvest, which had to be during that period of time. Logically, it has to come before Pentecost. The only logical and biblical and historical conclusion is that the wave sheaf is somehow linked to the days of unleavened bread. And we know that that Sabbath that's referred to in verse 11, it cannot mean the first or the last day of unleavened bread, at least not in most years. The reason for that is found in verse 15. You shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. And you can read the rest of that passage. We know that the 50 days ends on the day after a Sabbath. You can count 7 weeks. The very next day, day 50, is always on the first day of the week. Well, the problem with using the first day and the last day of unleavened bread as the Sabbath in question is that those days move around during the week. Some years, the first day of unleavened bread might be on a Tuesday. It's not always on a Sabbath. So what are we left with then? How do we know? This brings us to the two remaining options for this Sabbath in question. And this is the trickiest part, I suppose. It could mean the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. And there are some that would make that argument. It could also mean the weekly Sabbath that would place the next day, or the wave sheaf day, during the days of unleavened bread. Now, most years, that doesn't matter. Most years, it works out to being the same. But this distinction is important when the first day of unleavened bread is on Sunday, and the last day of unleavened bread falls on the weekly Sabbath. Then you have a question. Does the wafer sheaf have to come during the unleavened bread, or could it come after? Which point is key? Does the Sabbath in Leviticus 23 and verse 11, does that Sabbath have to be during unleavened bread, or does the wafer sheaf day have to be during the days of unleavened bread? Both would come after weekly Sabbaths. Both would be in the spring or the right season of the year, and both of those days would be linked to the days of unleavened bread. It results in just one day difference for Pentecost. Well, how do we know? Notice Leviticus 23 and verse 11 again. It says, "He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath." In verse 14, we're given some extra details about this day. It says, "You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and on your in all your dwellings." Verse 11 shows us that this wave sheaf ceremony would always take place on the first day of the week. And then there's this extra restriction that God places. You are not allowed to eat bread or parched grain or fresh grain from this annual harvest until you've offered the wave sheaf offering. And that's important in determining the distinction between which Sabbath we must use. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 5. Mr. Pennington referenced this from memory earlier. There's a historical event here that provides us some clues as to what God would have us do when making this judgment. In Joshua chapter 3 and Joshua chapter 4, we see a miracle that God does to bring the Israelites across the Jordan River and to finally bring them into the land that he had promised them. And we know the story and the miracles that went involved. In Joshua chapter 5, a new generation of Israelites would be circumcised. And they would begin to celebrate the first annual cycle of holy days where Israel had finally, as it says in Leviticus 23 and verse 10, come into the land. Let's notice what takes place here. Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10. "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho." This is the first time as a nation they would celebrate Passover in the land that God had promised them. That's on the 14th day of the month for the festival of Passover. Then in verse 11, notice what they do. "And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover." That would be the 15th day of the month. You can mark for your notes Numbers 33 verses 1 through 3. When Moses reviewed the journey of the Israelites, he said on the 15th day of the month, on the day after the Passover. So here, when we're told in verse 11 that they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, it's talking about the first day of unleavened bread, the 15th. They ate unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So they ate of this unleavened bread, of course, being the first day of unleavened bread, and they ate of the parched grain from the land of Canaan on the very same day. On the day after Passover, the 15th, they ate of this parched grain. Well, how could that be? How could they be allowed to do that? We read in Leviticus chapter 23 that parched grain could not be eaten until after the wave sheaf had been offered. And the wave sheaf is always offered on the day after a weekly Sabbath. It's always offered on a Sunday. In Joshua chapter 5, the parched grain is eaten on the 15th day of Abib. That would be the first day of unleavened bread. This account that we read about of the first Passover and unleavened bread when they came into Canaan, this account is only possible if Passover, the 14th, fell on the weekly Sabbath from Friday evening to Saturday evening, and the first day of unleavened bread was on Sunday, or the 15th. In this case, the wave sheaf was offered on the first day of unleavened bread. It wasn't after the Sabbath that fell during the days of unleavened bread, because that would have been the last day of unleavened bread. The only way you can make this line up is if Passover was on Saturday and the first day of unleavened bread was on Sunday. Any other day of the week, it wouldn't work. Imagine, for example, that Passover was on Tuesday. So they have Passover on Tuesday. First day of unleavened bread is on a Wednesday. It's not possible, because the wave sheaf can only be offered on a Sunday, and there's no Sunday between Tuesday and Wednesday. The only way this passage can work is if Passover was on Saturday, the first day of unleavened bread was on Sunday, so they offered the wave sheaf Sunday morning on the first day of unleavened bread, and they were allowed then to eat of the parched grain on that same day. Now, like I said, it's a bit technical. You almost have to draw a diagram to make this work. If you want help with a diagram, see me afterwards and I'll help you draw one. But why do we care? Why is this important for us? Is it just a bit of historical trivia, or is it important for us? Well, while we don't practice the ritual ceremony of offering a wave sheaf, there are several facets of the wave sheaf ceremony which merit our consideration today as Christians. The first and most obvious of those is that the wave sheaf ceremony serves as a bridge or a link between Passover and the days of unleavened bread and the Feast of Pentecost. Let's go back to Leviticus 23, and we'll see this direct link in Scripture. Leviticus 23 and verse 15. We're admonished, "And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord." Pentecost is the only holy day which does not occur on a specific day of the month. God tells us the first day of unleavened bread is on the 15th. We're told the Feast of Trumpets is on the first day of the month, and so forth. But this holy day of Pentecost requires that we count, which means that we must know when the wave sheaf ceremony occurred to correctly identify which Sunday is the day of Pentecost. A day of great significance, of course, for the church. We won't turn there, but Acts 2 and verse 1 describes the founding of the church. And Luke described the scene by saying, "When the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place." There was no disagreement over the date. And we know, of course, that Pentecost is so meaningful for the church. It was the day the church was founded. It reminds us of the giving of the Holy Spirit. And it's predicated on this understanding of when this wave sheaf offering would have been given. The mechanism of counting for Pentecost seems to be an intentional linking between Passover, the days of unleavened bread, and the completion of the first fruits harvest as celebrated at Pentecost. And since God makes that connection for us, should we not then meditate and consider what God wants us to learn about that connection? I would submit to you that we should. A second reason why we as Christians should care about the wave sheaf offering is that the symbolism of the wave sheaf ceremony would be fulfilled completely by Jesus Christ. This is where God's plan gets so interesting. Historically, the wave sheaf would have been offered around 9 o'clock in the morning, the time of the daily sacrifices. In Leviticus 23, we're given three keys about this ceremony. The sheaf would be waved before the Lord. It would be accepted by God on behalf of the people. And it would occur on the Sunday during the days of unleavened bread. It's remarkable when we fast forward through time to see how God the Father and Jesus Christ were so organized and systematic in fulfilling their plan. It's an appropriate time of year, I think, for us to consider these things. We think about what happened in the Passover in 31 AD. Jesus, of course, would have been killed on Passover Day, the 14th. Let's turn over to John 19. That year, that would have been on a Wednesday. And we know the story, and we've reviewed the background as we led up to Passover in the days of unleavened bread, and I'm sure we've all put in time thinking about what that was like. But in John 19 and verse 31, it says, "Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day." This was on the daylight portion of Passover. Christ, of course, was crucified. He would die and he would be buried that same day. Drop down to verse 38. "And this, after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took the body of Jesus, and Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. And they took the body of Jesus, bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. So there they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day, for the tomb was nearby." We see here the year that Jesus died, on Passover Day, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus make sure he's put in the tomb before sunset. This was on a Wednesday of that week. And we know that Jesus tells us that he would be in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. And of course, we know the teaching on that. That would have occurred late Wednesday afternoon through late Saturday afternoon when Jesus was in the tomb. Jesus would be resurrected late Sabbath afternoon as the Sabbath was nearing its end. We pick up the story in John 20 and verse 1. "Now the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb." As a side point, this shows that there was no sunrise resurrection, as so much of the Christian world would foist off on people. In verse 2, it says, "Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and the other disciple, whom Jesus loved, and said to them, 'They've taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.'" Again, for timing purposes, this is on the first day of the week, on a Sunday. It's still dark when she arrives at the tomb, and the tomb, of course, is already empty, Jesus having been resurrected late Sabbath afternoon. Drop down to verse 11. "But Mary stood outside the tomb weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. Then they said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' She said to them, 'Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.'" Verse 14, it says, "And when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?' She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, 'Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away.' And Jesus said to her, 'Mary.' She turned and said to him, 'Rabboni,' which is to say, 'Teacher.' Jesus said to her, 'Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father.'" When he tells her, "Do not cling to me," Young's literal translation renders it, "Be not touching me." The King James Version is simply, "Touch me not." The Greek English Interlinear New Testament renders it, "Do not hold to me." Why would Jesus tell her this? You can imagine she wants to give him a hug. Why would he say, "Don't touch me"? Seems rather abrupt. Why would he tell her that? Well, he gives the reason. "Do not cling to me," or "do not touch me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father and to my God and your God." Notice Matthew chapter 28. I have some other details from this particular day. Jesus, of course, told Mary, "I haven't yet ascended to my Father." This would have been on the Sunday during the days of unleavened bread, the day when the waif sheaf would be presented before God. Matthew 28, and this time in verse 9, we pick up the story later in the day. It says, "And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, Rejoice." And what did they do? "So they came and held him by the feet and worshiped him." This was the same day. Early in the morning, Jesus appears to Mary and says, "Look, you can't touch me." Now, later in the day, he says that he allowed them to hold him by the feet and to worship him. How could this be? He told her initially, "You can't touch me because I've not yet ascended to my Father." Well, the answer is that during this interval period of time, Jesus had ascended to the Father. He had been waived before God to be accepted on our behalf, thus fulfilling the symbolism of the wave sheaf ceremony. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 15. We're told this about Jesus Christ. It says, "But now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive." Jesus Christ was the perfect sacrificial lamb and the perfect wave sheaf for us. He would be waved before the Father. He would ascend to be presented and to be accepted on our behalf. So that, of course, leads us to the third point about why we care about the wave sheaf, and that is that it was an encouraging and a positive ceremony, because once the wave sheaf ceremony was complete, the harvest could truly begin in earnest. You might imagine for the Israelites the eagerness the people would have as they saw the barley beginning to ripen in their fields, and they wanted that harvest process to start. But before they could start the harvest, the wave sheaf ceremony needed to be conducted. So too, God the Father and Jesus Christ must have been excited about bringing their plan to fruition. Jesus told Mary, "Don't touch me, because I have not yet ascended to my Father." He would fulfill the ceremony of the wave sheaf to be presented before God, to be accepted on our behalf, so that the harvest could truly begin. In 1 Corinthians 15, Jesus is described as the first of the first fruits. He was the first to be raised to spirit life. He represents the beginning, the very first of God's spiritual harvest. Let's go back to Leviticus 23, and we'll see this connection once again with the wave sheaf. Leviticus 23, and we'll read again verse 10. Leviticus 23 and verse 10. It says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. This word first fruits literally means the first in place, the first in time, the first in order, the first in rank. And we'll see later as you go through this passage when we come to the Feast of Pentecost, it talks about other first fruits, and it's a different word. It's a word that doesn't mean the very first, because Christ always would be the first, the only first of the first fruits. Notice Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. Romans 8 verse 28, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. For whom he foreknew, he also predestined," or he planned, "to be conformed to the image of his Son, that Jesus, might be the firstborn among many brethren. As the wave's chief, Christ is the first among many brethren." It was the beginning of something wonderful. Paul would summarize this special role of Jesus Christ in Colossians 1 and verse 18, where he said, "He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence." He would always be the first in place, in time, in order, and in rank, just as the wave sheaf was. The sheaf that was waved before God on the Sunday during the days of unleavened bread was the very first of the spring harvest, a very hopeful symbol that the harvest was just beginning. And every year that harvest would begin and would lead up through the Feast of Pentecost, representing the harvest of the saints through time. Of course, that'll occur at Christ's return. This is the active, ongoing work of the God family today. God is calling and preparing a people. He is bringing many sons and daughters to glory. And this cycle of spiritual harvests began with the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf ceremony is a rather remarkable custom. It's the day when the wave sheaf was offered. It was always on the Sunday during the days of unleavened bread. And it is day number one in counting for Pentecost. We're, of course, now at day number seven. Jesus Christ fulfilled every aspect of the wave sheaf offering. His perfect sacrifice, accepted by the Father, makes possible the miracle of God's plan for us. The wave sheaf ceremony opened the land for harvest, as Christ's resurrection open God's plan for the saints through time. As we leave the days of unleavened bread this year, as that begins to fade in the background, we have already begun the count to Pentecost. Let's appreciate the rich symbolism that is embedded in this ancient ceremony.